The Inner Child and the Nude Politician. October 2014. Last summer, a company that makes literary t-shirts asked me for permission to use a quote. "The creative adult is the child who survived." I looked at the sentence and thought, did I write that sentence? I think I wrote something like it. But I hope not that sentence. Creative is not a word I use much since it was taken over by corporation think. But isn't any adult a child who survived? So I Googled the sentence. I got lots of hits, and boy, were some of them weird. In many of them, the sentence is ascribed to me, but no reference to a source is ever given. The weirdest one is at a site called quotesclothing.com. "My dear, the creative adult is the child who survived. The creative adult is the child who survived after the world tried killing them, making them grow up. The creative adult is the child who survived the blandness of schooling, the unhelpful words of bad teachers, and the naysaying ways of the world. The creative adult is, in essence, simply that. A child. Falsely yours, Ursula Le Guin." The oddest part of this little orgy of self-pity is "falsely yours," which I take to be a coy semi-confession of forgery by whoever actually wrote the rant. I've looked through my own essays for the sentence that could have been used or misused for the quote, because I still have a feeling there is one. So far, I haven't found it. I asked my friends in an SF chat group if it rang any bell with them, some of them being scholars with a keen nose for provenience, but none of them could help. If anybody reading this has a theory about the origin of the pseudo-quote, or better yet, a eureka with volume and page citation, would you please post it as a response at BVC? Because it's been bothering me ever since June. Footnote. Welcome responses to this blog post on Book View Cafe soon gave me both the sentence I wrote and a possible source of the misquotation. In the 1974 essay, "Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons?", reprinted in the collection The Language of the Night, I wrote, "I believe that maturity is not an outgrowing, but a growing up, that an adult is not a dead child, but a child who survived." Nothing about creativity whatever. I was just hissing at the notion that maturity is mere loss or betrayal of childhood. The misquote may have first appeared on the internet in 1999 in a huge and generally useful collection of quotations compiled by Professor Julian F. Flaren. When I wrote him, he was distressed to learn that it was a misquote and most amiably removed it at once. But a false attribution on the internet is like box elder beetles. The miserable little things just keep breeding and tweeting and crawling out of the woodwork. I checked just now, July 2016. Goodreads and AIGA continue to attribute the creative adult misquote to me. It has also taken on an independent existence and is even referred to by one source as the well-known saying. Oh, well. End of note. The sentence itself, its use and popularity, bothers me even more. Indifference to what words actually say. Willingness to accept a vapid truism as a useful, even revelatory concept. Carelessness about where a supposed quotation comes from. That's all part of what I like least about the internet. A blah, 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 who cares, information is what I want it to be attitude. A lazy-mindedness that degrades both language and thought. But deeper than that lies my aversion to what the sentence says to me, that only the child is alive and creative. so that to grow up is to die. To respect and cherish the freshness of perception and the vast polymorphous potentialities of childhood is one thing, but to say that we experience true being only in childhood and that creativity is an infantile function, that's something else. I keep meeting this devaluation of growing up in fiction and also in the cult of the inner child. There's no end of books for children whose hero is a rebellious misfit, a boy or girl, usually described as plain and almost predictably red-haired, who gets into trouble by questioning or resisting or ignoring the rules. Every young reader identifies with this kid, and rightly. In some respects, to some extent, children are victims of society. They have little or no power. They aren't given the chance to show what's in them. And they know it. They love reading about taking power, getting back at bullies, showing their stuff, getting justice. They want to do so that they can grow up, claim independence in order to take responsibility. But there's a literature written for both kids and adults in which human society is reduced to the opposition: kids good, creative, adults bad, dead inside. Here, the child heroes are not only rebellious, but are in all ways superior to their hidebound, coercive society and the stupid, insensitive, mean-minded adults that surround them. They may find friendship with other children, an understanding from a wise, grandparently type of another skin color, or from people marginal to or outside their society, but they have nothing to learn from adults of their own people, and those elders have nothing to teach them. Such a child is always right, and wiser than the adults who repress and misunderstand him, yet the super perceptive, wise child is helpless to escape. He is a victim. Holden Caulfield is a model of this child. Peter Pan is his direct ancestor. Tom Sawyer has something in common with this kid, and so does Huck Finn. But Tom and Huck are not sentimentalized or morally oversimplified, nor do they consent to be victims. They are described with and have a powerful sense of ironic humor, which affects the crucial issue of self-pity. The coddled Tom loves to see himself as cruelly oppressed by meaningless laws and obligations. But Huck, a real victim of personal and social abuse, has no self-pity at all. Both of them, however, fully intend to grow up, to take charge of their own lives, and they will. Tom, no doubt, is a successful pillar of his society. Huck, a freer man, out there in the territories. It seems to me the super-perceptive child victim of self-pity has something in common with the inner child. They're lazy. It's so much easier to blame the grown-ups than to be one. The idea that we all contain an inner child who has been suppressed by our society, the belief that we should cultivate this inner child as our true self, and that we can depend upon it to release our creativity, seems an over-reductive statement of an insight expressed by many wise and thoughtful people, among them Jesus: except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Some mystics and many great artists, aware of drawing on their childhood as a deep source of inspiration, have spoken of the need to maintain an unbroken inner connection between the child and the adult in one's own inward life. But to reduce this to the idea that we can open a mental door from which our imprisoned inner child will pop out and teach us how to sing and dance, paint, think, pray, cook, love, etc. A very wonderful statement of the necessity and the difficulty of maintaining a connection to one's own child self is Wordsworth's Ode on intimations of immortality. The poem offers a profoundly felt, profoundly thoughtful, radical argument. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. Instead of seeing birth as an awakening from blank non-being and fetal incompletion into the child's fullness of being, and seeing maturity as a narrowing, impoverishing journey toward blank death, the ode proposes that a soul enters life, forgetting its eternal being, can remember it throughout life only in intimations and moments of revelation, and will recall it and rejoin it fully only in death. Nature, says Wordsworth, offers us endless reminders of the eternal, and we are most open to them in our childhood. Though we lose that openness in adult life, when custom lies upon us with a weight heavy as frost and deep almost as life, still we can keep faith with those shadowy recollections which, be they what they may, are yet the fountain light of all our day, are yet a master light of all our seeing. Uphold us, cherish, and have power to make our noisy years seem moments in the being of the eternal silence. Truths that wake to perish never. I cherish this testimony particularly because it need not be seen as rising from the belief system of any religion. Believer and free thinker can share this vision of human existence passing from light through darkness into light, from mystery to endless mystery. In this sense, the innocence, the unjudging, unqualified openness to experience of the young child can be seen as a spiritual quality attainable or reattainable by the adult. And I think this is what the idea of the inner child originally or optimally is all about. But Wordsworth makes no sentimental plea to us to nourish the child we were by denying the value of maturity or by trying to be a child again. However conscious we are of the freedom and awareness and joyfulness we lose as we age, we live a full human life, not by stopping at any stage, but by becoming all that is in us to become. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind, in the primal sympathy which, having been, must ever be, in the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind. If, like me, you look at that word soothing in surprise, wondering how thoughts of human suffering can be soothing, perhaps you will feel as I do that such wonder is a key, a sign that the poet's direct language contains immensely more than its apparent clarity reveals at first, that nothing he says in this poem is simple, and that though it's easily understood, any understanding of it may lead on, if followed, to further understanding. The cult of the inner child tends to oversimplify what Wordsworth leaves complex, close off what he leaves open, and makes oppositions where there are none. The child is good, therefore the adult is bad. Being a child is great, so growing up is the pits. Sure enough, growing up isn't easy. As soon as they can toddle, babies are bound to toddle into trouble. Wordsworth had no illusions about that. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy. The transition to adulthood, adolescence, is difficult and dangerous, recognized as such by many cultures. All too often in punitive ways, such as cruel male initiation rites, or the brutal eradication of adolescence in girls by marrying them off as soon as they menstruate. I see children, as unfinished beings who have been given a very large job to do. Their job is to become complete, to fulfill their potential, to grow up. Most of them want to do this job and try their level best to do it. All of them need adult help in doing it. This help is called teaching. Teaching can, of course, go wrong, be restrictive or educative, be stultifying, cruel. Everything we do can be done wrong. But to dismiss teaching as a mere repression of childish spontaneity is a monstrous injustice to every patient parent and teacher in the world since the old Stone Age, and denies both children's right to grow up and their elders' responsibility to help them do so. Children are by nature, by necessity, irresponsible, and irresponsibility in them, as in puppies or kittens, is part of their charm. Carried into adulthood, it becomes a dire practical and ethical failing. Uncontrolled spontaneity wastes itself. Ignorance isn't wisdom. Innocence is wisdom only of the spirit. We can and do all learn from children all through our life, but become as little children is a spiritual counsel, not an intellectual, practical, or ethical one. In order to see that our emperors have no clothes on, do we really have to wait for a child to say so? Or even worse, wait for somebody's inner brat to pipe up? If so, we're in for a lot of nude politicians.